So we're obviously blocked from this power. We are powerless. And we've just made this decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. And on the bottom of page 63, it starts a section on step four with a real good reason why to do step four. It says, next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us never attempted, though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step. It could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. Most alcoholics at once is like months or years later. And it says next and it says at once, I think for a reason. I've watched guys take the third step and then take like a year and a half or 2 years or longer to finish to do the fourth step. And I had one guy that I sponsored, and it took him between a year and a half and 2 years before he finally got to his fifth step. And by the time he got to it, he was carrying a Mac 10 machine pistol in his truck because they were back. You know what I'm saying, right? He was at all that angst again and that paranoia and that self-centered fear, and he was in a lot of trouble. So at once followed by this strenuous effort to face and be rid of, that this decision in step three, even though it's vital and it's crucial, it's absolutely necessary to change the course of our life, to head in a different direction, that it in and of itself could have little permanent effect. One of the things that affected Bill Wilson a lot, and as a matter of fact, it was the first book Bill ever read. It was given to him in Towns Hospital by Ebby and another guy from the Oxford Group. And it was a book called The Varieties of Religious Experience by William James. And if you've ever read it, it's a hard, hard book to read. It's in a language that's hard to connect to with nowadays. It's just hard to connect to. But it's a series of taken from a series of seminars that James gave. And what James had done in this book, and I suspect it affected Bill Wilson profoundly, is that he, from a scientific point of view, tried to chronicalize people who had religious experiences, born-again experiences, epiphanies, huge transformations and rearrangements of a spiritual nature that changed their lives. And James studied these, and he discovered that they invariably had two things in common. You never had that experience when things were going well. You don't just get back from Vegas, you hit the mega bucks, you got $3 million, four new girlfriends, a great car, everybody loves you, and you think, you know, I'm going to look for God. It's never like that. It's always when you're broken and you're just, oh, God, you hate yourself. And then the second thing, and this ties into where Alcoholics Anonymous seems to deviate from most spiritual movements, is James found that throughout history, people had had these experiences, but invariably they were transitory experiences. Invariably, the shine of them would wear off, and the old personality, the ego, would reassert itself, and they'd be back to being the way they were, even though often they wouldn't even know that was happening to them. And I suspect that maybe that affected Bill Wilson, his seeing that from James's experience. We are the first movement that I know of in the history of the planet that not only can induce or create a spiritual experience in people like me that are dying, but can also maintain it. And maybe maybe we don't maintain it perfectly. We don't maintain it. We don't stay ultimately and absolutely surrendered. But if you stay involved in AA and you have a sponsor, and you sponsor people, and you go to meetings, and you try to do a 10th and 11th step and help other people, you may not be perfectly surrendered, but you will stay in the zip code. You will at least stay surrendered enough that you're not shooting yourself in the foot at least as much as when you were running the show. So we're looking for the things that have been blocking us. Blocking me from what? On page 55, it talks about the power deep down inside me that I'm blocked from. The book says I'm obscured by these aspects of self, calamity, all the self-centered fear that I generate in the process of running my life. The pomp. I get so full of myself and my judgments and my opinions and my way and the worship of other things, the things that I get in my crosshairs from time to time that I become obsessed with, that I'm absolutely convinced will fix me, that will, if I can make this so, or if I can change this, or if I can get this or have this or get rid of this or whatever, will have enabled me to have wrested happiness and satisfaction out of this world through this management. So I'm blocked from the God within me. I'm blocked from carrying out the decision in step three. I was pretty sincere about the third step. And because I got that I'm an idiot. I got that I'm the guy who's doing this to me. But my intention to turn my will and my life over to the care of God in and of itself is nothing. The problem is I'm blocked from carrying out the decision. And I get on my knees, say the third step prayer. 20 minutes later, I'm running the universe. My friend Charlie has a great definition of an agnostic. He says most people think agnostics are people who aren't sure if there's a God or not. And that's true. That is part and parcel of what is to be an agnostic. But he said a better definition for us would be a person who's absolutely convinced that God's running the universe, but goes about their life like they are. Right? And why can't I let go? I'm blocked from surrendering my will and my life. And then I'm also blocked from people. Alcoholics, drunk or sober, we live in untreated alcoholism is a lonely business. We are blocked from people. This awkward inability to fit, to connect with people, to be intimate the way other people seem to be intimate. That's why do you ever sit when you're drinking or even early sobriety and you watch those love story movies on TV? And you just know that's, God. The one I hated the most was at Christmas time. I'd usually end up in an institution watching the TV set either in the day room or something, you know. And they'd always have that movie on, It's a Wonderful Life. Where the whole community comes running to his rescue. And I just would sit there and hate him. Nobody'd ever do that for me. Why am I blocked from other people? So we're looking to uncover, Chuck would say, discover and discard the things within us that are blocking us from carrying out this decision, from the God within us and from life itself and people. So what do we do? It says, therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking commercial inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. It's an effort to discover the truth about stock and trade. My first two inventories, I didn't follow the procedure in the book. And I wrote, the first one was my life story, and I was pretty honest. I mean, I put down every sleazy little secret. But I did not find or face any facts about me. Everything that was on there, I knew. I didn't discover any truth about me. Now, the only benefit I got out of it was I shared some secrets with a guy that was my sponsor at the time. But nothing had really changed. I wasn't unblocked. I still got all the judgments. I'm not any closer to God. I'm not any closer to you. And I'm not any closer to carrying out the decision in step three or living this. I'm still blocked. So what do we do? But says we did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Remember, Paulie was talking about earlier the root of our troubles, selfishness, self-centeredness. And on a previous page, and I just saw this a few years ago too, there's these little big book elves that GSO sends out to change my book occasionally. On the bottom of 61, it says something I'd read it 100 times and didn't get it until one day I got it. It says our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. In other words, they're talking about the same thing. Ego and self. Self-centered and ego-centered are the same thing. When I got that, all of a sudden, a lot of the things that Harry Thibault talked about started making sense in the light of what it talks about on page 63 or 60 through 63. It's ego. It's that part of me that wants to play God, that wants to run the universe. It's what it various manifestations of self is what had defeated us. Resentment is the number one offender. You know, when I was new, I wouldn't have thought that. I would have thought it was guilt. Because I was overwhelmed with remorse and guilt when I got sober. But oddly enough, guilt is not a sustaining situation. There are things that I was a very precocious young kid when I was 12, 13 years old, 14. By the time I was 15, almost 16, I was already in juvenile court three times. I was always in a lot of trouble. And I did a lot of things on a regular basis that I felt guilty for back in those days. But you know something? I can't even tell you what most of that stuff was. I don't even remember it. Because what happens with guilt in me is the feelings will push me to face what the conflict, and then unbeknownst to me, I'm actually making a sort of an amends. I face it. I say, I'm sorry. I pay the person back, or I got caught and had to pay the person back, or whatever. Or there's another phenomenon that happens. There's a time after you've committed the act, somewhere in the future, where you're at that place where you finally know beyond a shadow of a doubt, there's not going to be any consequences for what I did. I'm out of the woods. And consequently, no longer guilty. But resentments are forever. I when I got sober, I could still tell you what my second grade teacher did. I could still tell you about the guy that was 7 years old when I was 5 years old and who beat me up. I could still tell you everything out of line that I thought my parents had ever done. I could still tell you how my sister, what she did to steal their affection. I could have told you all of that. So resentments really are the number one offender. It says it destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Maybe more than alcohol. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. That's really true. There's a lot of very brilliant doctors today in holistic medicine that believe that we are one being. And that when my spirit gets sick, my body kind of follows along with things. There's theories now that people actually build tumors around resentments and about guilt over and around guilt. That diseases like migraine headaches, chronic depression. panic disorder, spastic colitis, ulcers, on and on and on, are all spiritually based. And a lot of mental illnesses, they're starting to think that they're spiritually based either. Because what happens when I am in conflict with God, myself, and life itself? I start spinning in my head. Because now I got stuff to defend. Now I got to justify certain things I've done. Now I have to bend my mind around what's going on and make it seem like it's okay. Or make it seem like it's your fault. And I start to get crazy. I had a phone call. I don't know if I've ever talked about this. There was a guy in Vegas probably 10 years ago that I tried to sponsor. And he did really well. We went up through the fourth step. And he was a guy that was crazy in AA. I mean, he'd get in fist fights with people in the meetings. I watched him one day in a meeting. He got called on to share, and he was very insecure about sharing, and he starts to open his heart up and share a little bit. And there's two knucklehead guys I know are sitting in the back of the room. They're not even paying attention to the meeting. They're talking with each other, goofing and telling jokes or something. They start laughing, and he stops in the middle of the share when he sees them laugh, and he shuts it down. He says, "I don't have anything more to say." And I sat there in the meeting. I watched him. I watched the veins in his neck just... I could see he was grinding his teeth. And he sat there for about 5 minutes, and then I watched him get up. He walked over to the one guy, and he says, "Can I talk to you for about something?" And the guy said, "Yeah, sure." And they walked out. The second they got outside the meeting room, he starts hammering this guy in the head because he thought they were laughing at him, right? They weren't laughing at him. They're just being self-obsessed knuckleheads is all they're doing. Which is a good reason why you shouldn't crosstalk in meetings. But anyway, I started taking the guy through the steps, and through the fourth step, we started to dismantle this fear-based, self-centered judgment machine that was creating the conflict. And man, he started being a greeter at my home group. He was taking meetings into detox. It was great. And then I watched him take charge again. It was a sad thing to watch, and all of a sudden I couldn't talk to him. He started picking everybody apart in AA again. He started being the guy with all the judgments again. And he eventually relapsed. I got a phone call from one night from him, and he said he's sober. I don't know if he's sober or not. And he started to tell me that he knew that I was part of the conspiracy. And, oh, what conspiracy? Well, Clancy's the head of it, and you're one of his minions. And he says, now I'm in Southern California, and it says no matter what meetings I go to, Clancy sends his people to those meetings to share at me. He's insane. And what happened? He got spiritually sick first. And his mind just kind of followed, and his body kind of followed. I sponsored a guy years ago when he was 14 years sober. As a result of the internet, he found some websites that enabled him to start acting out on some sexual stuff that he kept at bay for 14 years. And he became crazier and crazier, and then he started getting sick physically. And the doctors don't know what's wrong with him. And they started putting him on medications. And he got addicted to drugs again. And then he eventually drank. And within 3 years, a guy who was coaching soccer, a guy who was went to the gym, he was a great specimen of vitality and health. Within 3 years, he looked like an 80-year-old man dying of cancer. Matter of fact, another guy's sponsor was at a meeting one time. And the guy's in the meeting, and he leaned over and said to me, he says, "Hey, have you seen so-and-so for a while?" I said, "Yeah, he's right over there." And Craig looked at him and went, "Oh, my God, that can't be him." It was almost like the picture of Dorian Gray. Did you ever see that movie? Where his spirit started to get sick, and his body and his mind just followed right along. And the problem is, I don't connect the dots. The doctors didn't know what was wrong with him. His stuff started to fail. I knew what was wrong with him. You can't convince me anything else. I knew that he started to get sick spiritually and his everything else just followed along. And the opposite's also true. That's why we're not, we put the mental and physical stuff, we don't even really deal a lot with that here. We deal with the spiritual. And oddly enough, most people that live this way of life are not perfectly mentally healthy, but they're in the ballpark. I mean, they function in the world where people couldn't function. And physically, it's not unusual that you do this. If you don't pick up another addiction like eating or something else, or some kind of other deal, that you stay physically pretty healthy. So in dealing with resentments, what do? It says first direction. It says we set them on paper. So I'm going to make a list. It says we listed the people, institutions, or principles whom we were angry. I discovered in my experience, and I've listened to a lot of fifth steps, that 90% or more of it's usually people. I mean, there's some institutions. The IRS is a big one that comes up on a lot. Some churches are real big on some people. The army. But even a lot of those institutions or principles, like the 50. I know a guy that was back when he couldn't go over 55. He was just pissed at the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. But a lot of the institutions that you can get angry at, when you look more specifically, you find out it's not really the army, it's that drill sergeant that made my life miserable. It's not really the police, it was that cop that beat the crap out of me. It's not really the Catholic Church, it was just that priest that took advantage of me. It's really an individual. But we are great at throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, that's what prejudice is. It's a natural thing. Do you ever notice when you really hate someone, you don't just hate them. You hate everyone that likes them, right? You hate everyone that lives on their street, everyone that works for them. Everyone who doesn't hate them, you hate, right? It's like it spreads like a cancer. So I listed the people, institutions, or principles, column one on page 65. Now, the book, I'm one who's learned how to do this by going through the book, and every time it said to do something or implied I should do something, think something, see something, realize something, write something, I tried to do what it said. And I found, and there could be more, but I found there's six things in the resentment section that I need to do. The first thing is column one on page 65. Now, these are not all writing things. Some of them are just realizations, prayers, etc. But the first thing I do is column one is I list the people, institutions, or principles with whom I'm angry. Column number two, it says we ask ourselves why we were angry. So column one's who, column two is why. And if you'll notice on page 65 in column two, it's very brief, to the point, bullet points. And I think that's very important. There's a tendency in every one of us to pull out this case file that's about this big on somebody we hate. And I'll tell you, 95% of it is peripheral stuff that I've used to justify hating them. My second grade teacher, I was resentful at her. If you'd ask me why, wow, she hates boys. That vow of celibacy has messed her up. You know what she did to my friend Welly? You know what she did to Tommy? You know how uptight she is? And I told you all this peripheral stuff. But the real truth is, one day, because I think I'm above the rules, I didn't do my homework, and I came to class and I got embarrassed in front of the whole class. And did you ever notice when you have a resentment, from that moment on, they can't do anything right? Did you ever notice that? Because the ego demands being right about that judgment. It demands it. It doesn't care if it kills. The ego doesn't care if it kills you, as long as you're right. And so from that moment on, she couldn't do anything right. And I just built the case on her. But what the real truth was, that she'd hurt my feelings. I was embarrassed in front of the class. So to the point, column number two. column number three, it says in most cases it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, which is another way of saying me getting my own way, and our personal relationships, including sex, so including also sexual relationships, were hurt, first of all, first word it uses, or threatened, the second word they're using to talking about the third column. So we were sore, we were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries, third word that it uses to describe what we're looking for in column number three. Was it our self-esteem, our security? And in the 12 by 12, it talks about material and emotional security. Our ambitions, our personal sex sex relationships, which had been interfered with. The fourth word it uses to describe what we're looking for in column number three. And then the fifth word it uses on the top of column number three affects mine. So I'm looking for the aspects of self that are hurt, threatened, injured, interfered with, or affected. And I like having guys I sponsor ask themselves with all five of those things, because it's like circling a building. Sometimes I'll ask myself, well, what was interfered with? I don't know. What was hurt? I don't know. What was threatened? My pride was threatened. And it's like circling a building. Each one of those words gets you to look at the same thing, but it's kind of from a little bit different perspective. Mm-hmm. Until all of a sudden you ask yourself the right question. It's like, bingo. My self-esteem was injured. My pride was injured. My pride was affected. It was hurt. So these are the first three columns. Now, on occasion, I've run into people in Alcoholics Anonymous that's all they do is these first three columns. And I tell you, in my experience, if that's all you do, you will get sicker, because you've just re-victimized yourself at a great depth. You've got your case here. There's only one value that I actually – there's only one real value that I found – two real values I found from the first three columns. One is I get a glimpse that there's fear involved in every resentment because something was threatened. And then another value, and this does have even more, is that I get to separate the person I hate from what they did in column two and start to see I don't really hate the person. I hate what they did. Because in every single case, if they hadn't have done that, they wouldn't be on the list. It is the cause that I'm really angry at and pissed at. So in the bottom of page 65, it says, we went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing that apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. Very apparent. Everybody who writes the resentment list, aren't you unconsciously making a list of people that you know owe you an amends? They really do. These are the stupid people. These are the idiots. These are the ones that need straightening out. To conclude that others were wrong as far as most of us ever got, the usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse. And then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters only got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. What is remorse and depression? At the late at night, I take the stick that I've been mentally beating you with and I turn it on myself? Uh-huh. When I unleash and feed the dogs of judgment within me, this aspect of my ego that likes to climb up onto the throne of judgment and just tear everybody down, the problem is it doesn't stop with you. It always comes back. They always come back and bite me. I went to therapy for years wanting to be free of this depression and the way I beat myself up, but yet still feel vindicated and right about how screwed up I think you are. And that's why one of the great things, lines in the Lord's Prayer, is forgive us our trespasses as. You want to stop beating yourself up? You want to feel better about yourself? You want to stop being depressed? Stop beating others up. You can't change the way you feel about yourself directly. But if you change your perception and relationship to others, what happens is it comes back on you. As you reel in the dogs of judgment and have a more loving, kinder, accepting, tolerant attitude towards others, you start, unbeknownst to you, subtly you start doing the same thing to yourself. All of a sudden, as this kindness and acceptance and tolerance that I'm willing to give to others, in weak moments after I've screwed up, I'll find myself doing something I never did before. Taking myself off the hook and say, Bob, you did the best you could. If I screwed up, man, I was good for a week or 2 week depression as I beat myself up. So it is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? But with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave, like in graveyard. We found that it is fatal, for when harboring such feelings, I like that word, harboring. It's almost nurturing. It's just these little judgments I have of how people have wronged me. I get up like delicate flowers. I just water them and take care of them, harbor and nurture them. My ego demands that I'm right about these people. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again, and with us to drink is to die. If you've ever in sobriety had a deep-seated resentment, and I've had a couple, you're cut off, man. You can't hear nothing in a meeting. You can't pray effectively. There is no conscious contact. That resentment just owns you and gets right here. You can't see past it. You can't pray. You can try. I just try. When I was going through my first divorce and all that stuff happened, I'd get down on my knees and say, God, please help me to stay sober. I hope you kill them very slowly. Oh, it just bleeds into everything, you know? And then I go, oh, no, I shouldn't think that, right? Cut off. I was lucky to stay sober. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for the alcoholic, they are poison. It's another death threat. We turned back to the list, for it held the key to the future. Now, by this time, I should be getting it, that I'm going to die if I hang on to this stuff. It's going to keep me locked up inside of me at the wheel of my own life, and I'm going to run it into the rocks again and again and again. It's keeping me in a state of separation, loneliness. We turned back to the list, for it held the key to the future. And I think this could be a question. I think it's a paramount statement. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. Am I prepared? And what would that mean? Well, the first three columns in what I've done all my life, haven't I really been looking at these people as the point of view of a prosecuting attorney? I mean, this is my case, and I'm good at convincing you. I can have a resentment towards somebody in AA, find up five other people in the meeting that I'll get to agree with me. Oh, that guy really is an asshole. Oh, yeah. That's my case. I'm the prosecuting attorney. So if I were to look at it from an entirely different angle, what would I do? Wouldn't I cross the courtroom? And wouldn't I sit on the defense table and start to look at this situation through their eyes? Well, how would it look to them? Now, most of the ego balks at that, because that's threatening our being right about these people. But I guess the question is, do you want to be free or do you want to be right? You got to pick one or the other. You can't be both. Every alcoholic wants to be free and right. You want to be happy and joyous and free, or do you want to be right? And hopefully by this time I've surrendered enough that I want to be free. I'm like the rat. Enough cheese, I want out of this trap. Because the cheese is rotten. So am I prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle? And then it goes on and says, in that state, we began to see that the world and its people really dominate us. In that state, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, had the power to actually kill. Fancied or real. Well, I'll tell you about, it's this, when you, if you do this inventory, maybe not on the first one, by about the time you do the second or third one, I start getting something, how fancied a lot of these resentments are. There might be a kernel of reality, and then I tell my story to myself about what happened, and then it's not real anymore. Fancied or real. Can I go to...
I'll go an hour on fear and sex.
I'll tell you a little story. There was a guy in early sobriety who used to help a lot of new guys like me. He was sober a while, named Billy Taylor. And Billy was a good guy. I went out to coffee with Billy one night after a meeting. And because he was easy to talk to, I shared with Billy some of my secrets. And what I'm talking about are those things that are in you that you don't want anybody to know about. You know, there's maybe things you did in a blackout, or maybe it's those things that you're really ashamed of. And everybody I've ever talked to in AA's got some of that stuff. Sometimes it might not be such a big dramatic thing. Other people have real dramatic stuff. But we all have that stuff that we'd like to take to the grave that we don't want anybody to know about. Some of you, maybe you went out partying, trying to get lucky, you forgot about your kids, came back the next day and you realized you left them alone. And something terrible could have happened. Maybe in a drunken rage or hungover and irritable, maybe you beat your kids. Maybe you can still see their eyes, the fear and terror in their eyes. Maybe one night you came home and you just lost your job as a result of your drinking, and you lost your relationship, and you did some things you don't like yourself for, and you hate yourself. Maybe you have a dog and the dog comes up to lick your face and you just flip out and start kicking the dog. How dare anything love somebody like me? Maybe you can't, as I remember now, the dog cowering, how from that moment on it never really came right up to me quite again like it used to. And I can't get it out of my mind. Or maybe the sexual things I've done that I'm just ashamed of. Maybe you had sex with someone that you wouldn't even want to have lunch with, you know? Maybe you had sex outside your species. I don't know what your deal is. I don't know if it's you lied to your... about somebody at work and they lost their job. I don't know. But we all have that stuff. And I'm telling Billy my stuff, and he seemed to take it okay. He didn't reject me. But he didn't say, yeah, me too. That would have helped. If he had said, oh, yeah, I did that. No, he didn't say that. That bothered me a little bit. Instead, he said, well, I'm sure you're not the only person that's ever done that. One day that'll probably help somebody. And He didn't reject me, so I didn't think too much of it, even though it did somewhere sound a little bit like the AA party line. I went home that night, and that week I got my shift changed at work, and now I'm working until midnight every night, and I'm forced to go to noon meetings. And so I don't see Billy for the good part of a year because I'm not going to the same meetings where I used to see him. And then one night on my night off, I went to a meeting I normally wouldn't go to. And Billy's in the meeting, and I was glad to see him because he had been an important part of my early sobriety. I saw him across the room, and he's kind of looking in my direction. I said, hey, Billy, how you doing? And he looks at me with this pained look on his face, and then he just turns away like he didn't even want to look at me. And the meeting started, and I'm sitting there, and I know what's going on. I know that he's been judging me for that stuff. I know that he had contempt for me because... And you know something? I couldn't blame him. I've always believed that if you knew about me what I know about me, you'd feel about me the way I feel about me. And I sat there and I am hurt, and I know he's been judging me for that stuff. And after about 2 or 3 minutes, I had this epiphany. The epiphany was, oh my God, wait a minute. It's more than that. It's not just that he's judging me. The reason he can't look me in the eye, that SOB's been telling people that stuff. And it became so clear. I just asked a girl out to coffee recently, and she's friends with him, and she wouldn't go. I knew he told her that crap. There was another guy who's a running partner of him, and he's been distant. And I knew he's been telling people, now I'm insane. I am going to beat the crap out of this guy. And I'm cocked and ready. And as soon as the meeting's over, man, I'm going to tear into this guy. And the chairman says, before we close the meeting, does anybody have a burning desire? Billy raises his hand, tells everybody in the room that the biopsy came back and the tumor's malignant and it's terminal, and his doctor thinks he has only a few months to live. And I sat there and I felt that big. And I sat there and I realized that Billy had never talked bad about me. Billy never judged me. What I saw on his face has nothing to do with me. Is that he was so frightened as a result of knowing he's going to die, as I would be, that he was so far up in his head in pain, he didn't even know I was there or anybody else. And it was like a postcard from God. Dear Bob, you don't know crap. Love God. I had that event and a couple others like that where I was just convinced I was so right about something and found out I was so wrong. And it was crucial because to dismantle this judgment machine that is my ego, is my will, the dismantling process starts with resentments. As I see, to my amazement, the exact nature of my wrongs is how I'm going to see how wrong I've been about everybody on this list. But how do you get to that point? Well, the next paragraph says, or the next couple lines, it says, how could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We've spent a whole page telling it's going to kill you. But how? And then here's the kicker. It says we cannot wish them away any more than alcohol. Well, then what'd you even tell me for? You mean to say that now that I know resentments are going to kill me, I can't just decide I'm never going to have them again? No. It's the same thing as with alcohol. Remember when you, after about the second treatment center, you knew this stuff's killing you and you made your mind up, I'm never going to drink again. There you are, drunk again. Right? So what do we do? And here's where I started getting the change. It says this was our course. Matter of fact, it's the only course in order to master these that the book gives me. And it's asking me here to realize something, to make something real that it's never been real before to me. I got to connect the dots inside myself about something in this situation I've never seen before realized. And it's asking me to realize that the person who'd wronged me was perhaps spiritually sick. Now, that's an easy one. Yeah, they're sick and they're idiots too, and I'm going to get even one day. But that's not all it says. It goes on to say, though we did not like their symptoms, and that's column number two, what they did, though I did not like their symptoms and the way these actions are disturbed me, that I'm supposed to realize that they are like me, perhaps spiritually sick. They, like myself, were sick too. What does that mean? It means that I had to go through every resentment and see honestly something I could never see. I had to come down off the throne of judgment and put myself in their shoes and get humble enough and honest enough with myself to get that if I was raised the way they were raised, if I'd been abused the way they were abused, if I was afraid the way they were afraid, if I had everything coming at me that was coming at them, can I get it that I could have easily done to someone else what they'd done to me? or do I need to still maintain my feeling of smug superiority? Or can I really get that that's me? That's me on a bad day. That's me with a worse childhood. That's me with a combination of things going on inside of them that maybe never actually hit at the same time with me. But if they did, that's me. That's me. And man, I'll tell you something. When I started to when I got honest enough with myself and went back through that stuff, the world changed. I had a guy about 15, 17 years ago that I was sponsoring. He was going through a fifth step. And we got to the worst resentment. It was in the middle. He buried it about a third of the way through. And it was for his father. And his father was a bad alcoholic and a rageaholic. And his father would get drunk and beat this kid, broke his bones. He ended up in the hospital on many occasions. His father was off the charts, man. His father, then sometimes his father would quit drinking for a period of time, and that was worse because he was so irritable. And he was like a dry alcoholic. You know, sometimes I don't know if we're worse drunk or sober. You know, because we're the idiot without benefit of anesthetic, you know. And his dad would scream and yell and shut up and get to your room. The kid had to create a whole fantasy life at school because he could not bring anybody home because he was ashamed of the monster. And so he could never had any good relationships with kids growing up. Nobody knew where he lived. He used to just meet guys down at the corner. Nobody could come to his house. And this is a resentment that ate this guy's lunch for a couple decades. He'd spent years in therapy trying to get free of it. Beat pillows, did all the gestalt chair, all of that stuff. Could never get free of it. And we get to this, and he's talking about the resentment. We get to this was our course, and I read a little part out of the 12x12 in step 10 where Bill says as we start to approach true love and tolerance of others, we start to realize how they, like ourselves, were suffering from the pains of growing up. We're often emotionally ill, just like us, and often wrong, just like us. And we start to see ourselves in these people. And I said to him, and this was our course, I said, you have to realize how you're like your dad. And he got pissed at me. And he started yelling at me. He says, I ain't like my cuss word. I ain't like my father. My father was an animal. He was a selfish monster. And he went on for, it seemed like an eternity. It was probably only a few minutes. All this venom coming out of him. And he's freaking me out. I don't do well in people that are exploding like that. So I just kind of back off. I just think to myself, well, I guess he's not prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle, I suppose. And I don't know what to do. So I just said, go on. And he started reading this other resentment, the next one on the list. And I can't hear him because there's something going on inside of me that is not of me, but through me. And I think it's going on because I asked God before, as I always do before I listen to a fifth step, to come into what we're doing and make me useful. And I stopped him and I said, I want to go back to another resentment. And he says, yeah, you want to talk more about my father? I said, no. Let's go back. In the beginning, there was that woman that you resented for rejecting you. You lived with her for a while. You had their kids, right? He said, yeah, what of it? I said, I just wondered all of a sudden if in that relationship, if there was ever a time when you were drunk or stoned on drugs or hungover that you might have ever done anything to hurt those kids. And he gets this weird look on his face and he puts his head down. And I don't know what's going on with this guy. And when he puts his head back up, he's got tears just running down this one side of his face. And he says with this horrible voice, this choked whisper, like it was out of some abyss or something. He said, I'm just like my goddamn father. I said to him, I said, how did you feel about yourself when you hurt those kids? He said, I couldn't stay drunk enough. I said, you think your dad's any different? And he stopped for a minute and he thought, and he said, you know something? I haven't seen my father for years. Nobody has anything to do with him except my sister. She goes and visits him once in a while. But she says that he lives in this trailer all by himself. He's got pancreatitis and liver damage, and his body will not metabolize alcohol. And she says he's the most neurotic, depressed, miserable person she's ever known. And she's the only one that has anything to do with him. He's totally alone. And he said maybe that would be a vision of my future without Alcoholics Anonymous. And we started going through the last part in the middle of page 67 after the prayer. And there's a prayer for action. And the prayer is we ask God to help us to show them, which means demonstrate, act towards them, to show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. And the questions in the middle of page 67 are started out with a thought. And it says, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. And about four lines down, it says the same thing in different words. It says we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Well, by the time I took this guy through this, I was finally of the school of thought that we don't look for our part here. Matter of fact, just the verbiage of looking for my part has an implication that is contrary to what it says here in the book. The book doesn't talk about our part. It says we disregard the other person involved entirely. And I got this from watching a guy make amends. If I think in terms of my part, here's my part. There's an implication. There's another part. It's their part. Now, whose part do you think I'm going to think is bigger? Right? If I think in terms of part, I'm still reserving my right to believe that they are part of this. That, and the book says we disregard the other person involved entirely. Where was I to blame? And I'm looking for my mistakes. And when he did that, all of a sudden, what he realized is the exact same thing I realized. I could not hide my bad behavior and my selfishness in the shadow of anything you've done wrong. And I was a master at that. I'll tell you, I was the kind of guy, if I worked for somebody and I caught my boss taking home merchandise, I was a license to steal. My God, he's doing it. I often suspect... That's one of the reasons I was so judgmental, because I needed the angst and the leverage to get away with all my selfish crap. If I could find enough stuff wrong with you, it gave me license. I remember at one time, oh God, I was the kind of guy, if you cheated on me, I was in a relationship with you, I was like 5 get some free tickets, right? And I would justify all this horrible, selfish, self-centered crap by pointing to what you did. The book says, no, we're not doing that anymore. What if I had perfect parents? What if I can't look at what they did? What if I just looked at what kind of a son was I on its own? And my friend started doing that, and he realized he was a terrible son. He had borrowed thousands and thousands of dollars from his father, never paid back a dime because his father was an idiot. His father's a monster. Doesn't deserve to be paid back. He gossiped and slandered about his father to everyone who would listen, and consequently, everybody in the family had turned against his dad, except for the one sister. For some reason, she was resentful too, but she kept going over and seeing him. And he thought to himself, my God, how could I have been a worse son to a sick man who was sick like I was sick? How could I have been a worse son? And he went to make amends to his dad. He called me up from outside the trailer park, and he was very upset. I said, what's wrong? He says, I'm scared. I said, what are you afraid of? He said, the monster. And we talked a little bit about God, and we talked a little bit about the purpose of his visit and what he was there for. And he went, and he called me later. And I said, what happened? He says, well, I went to the door of the trailer. I was shaking inside, knocked on the door. And the monster didn't answer the door. What answered the door was this little, scared, shaken, sick old man. And I could see the loneliness and the depression and the despair in his eyes. And he said, I looked in my father's eyes and I saw myself. And he started to take care of his father and go over there regularly. And he took care of his father till his dad died. And he'll tell you to this day, he lives in Texas, he'll tell you to this day that one of the greatest things AA gave him, in addition to his sobriety, is he got his daddy back. What a powerful thing. See, the problem is always our perception that must change. The ego makes these judgments about people and then will defend them to our demise. It'll defend them into our loneliness. It'll defend them into our destruction because it doesn't care. It just wants to be right. There are people in this room that will die of alcoholism because you can't give it up. You would rather be right than be free. See, the great I Am's got you by the short hairs. It's punking you out. And hopefully some of us get to a point where we don't need to, I don't want to be right no more. I don't want no more of this. I don't want no more of this. What a great, great freedom. I'll tell you a quick little story, and then we're going to take a break, and Polly's going to come back and talk about fear-induced sex right here in this room. When I was in my 11th year of sobriety, I found myself going through a divorce that I didn't really want to go through, and a divorce that I didn't even know why it was coming. Because I don't pay attention. I'm so busy working. I'm working 70 hours a week, and I've got my AA commitments. And I think everything's fine because I'm fine, right? And my wife came to me, and she says, I want out of the marriage. And I talked her out of it, the divorce, and I said, let's go to some marriage counseling. And she agreed to it, and we started going to marriage counseling. And my sponsor, Dick, was retired, and he bought a bus, and he was gone. He was on the East Coast just doing this protracted almost a year tour of the United States in this bus. And so my confidant became a guy that I sponsored, who was like, you know, you always have one sponsee you kind of like goof around with a lot, and he's come, you get close to him. Well, I had this one favorite sponsee at the time, Craig, and he became my confidant about my marriage problems. Well, my wife came to me after a couple months of counseling, says, I don't want to do the counseling anymore, I'm done, I want out. And I live in Las Vegas. Las Vegas, you can get, if you don't fight a divorce, you can get divorced quick, man. I'm telling you, you haven't even got the visa bill for the divorce. You're single already. You know, it's that quick. It's fast. And we were divorced on a Thursday. And the next day I find out that my daughter, Katie, who I love, I cut her umbilical cord, gave her a first bath. She has my heart. And to this day has never given it back. And my daughter and my wife moved in with Craig, my best friend, my confidant. And you guys have been, and I found out that everybody, it seemed like in AA, knew about it except me. Man, I'm tore up. Every area of my life that could be threatened, hurt, or affected was torn up. You'd been telling me for almost 10 years, there's no such thing as a justifiable resentment. Well, I got one now. I can even find people in AA that'll agree with me. You know, I tell them my tale of woe, and they'd say, Bob, and didn't you just get her a new car? And I go, yeah, and the nail holes in my hands would open up a little more, you know, from the cross. And right. And, you know, if you've ever been in that spot, there's a little ego pump for a very short period of time. But without a bottle of wine or vodka, you can't sustain that kind of deal very long. And I started getting sick. It started wearing on me. And I went back through this process, and I had to put both their names down, column number one. Column number two, what happened? The lies, the infidelity. Column number three, what was hurt, threatened, affected, injured, everything, absolutely everything. And then the book asked me those questions. Are you prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle? And I was at a place where I don't want to be right no more. I don't care. I just want to be free of this. I had saw a friend of mine who had been in the same situation become friends with the guy who slept with his wife. And I thought, I got, and he was happy. And he wasn't locked up like I was. I thought, I want that. And I read the once again, and thank God I'd done this early in my sobriety. This was our course, and I I had to somehow realize, I had to put myself in their place. I had to put myself in Karen's place. What would it have been like to be married to me? And what I got was this, the thing I got was just not easy to look at. I got that it's a gal that not involved in AA like I am. Matter of fact, she hasn't been to a meeting in 10 years. She's fine. I don't even know if she's alcoholic. She might be. I don't know. She wasn't involved. She didn't work. She didn't have a business. She didn't have the involvement, the sponsees, the commitments in AA to fill her vacancies the way I did. She married me and made me the center of her life, and in no time at all, she's married to a guy that's just not there very much. And I started to get a sense of her loneliness and desolation in that marriage. And because she grew up in an alcoholic household at that time, that changed in later years, but she had an inability to express her feelings and do anything that even resembled confrontation. She couldn't do it. And when I really got it, what it must have felt like to have been her in that marriage, I thought to myself, my God, I'd had an affair too. And I probably would have hated myself for doing it. And Karen, it almost consumed her, the guilt over that. I remember when I went to make amends to her. Isn't it funny? I would have told you before I did the process, you know, she really owes me an amends. And when I came out the other side and I realized that I owed her an amends, I'd been a terrible husband. In all the areas where it really counted, I wasn't there. I was a good provider and I never cheated on her. And I did a lot of things right. But where she needed me, I wasn't there. And all the business and the AA stuff was all convenient for a guy who doesn't know how to become emotionally accessible, who doesn't know how to do intimacy. So what do? As I stay busy, and I married her. I was young in sobriety. I didn't think so. I was 5 or 6 years sober. When you're 5 or 6 years sober, you think you've arrived. But I was really very young in sobriety, really, really and truly. And I realized I went to make amends to her. And I made amends. I still to this day make this as a living amends. As I told her how sorry I was and how much I regretted talking bad about her. Because I went around to A meetings to ventilate my pain. Well, that was crap. You know what I was really doing? I want to get everybody in the meeting to hate her like I hate her. That's what I'm really doing. Right? And so I've gone for the last 18, I don't know how many years, a lot of years now, telling everybody that the truth, that I was the guy that screwed that marriage up. That she didn't do anything in that marriage I wouldn't have done if I would have been in her shoes. That it was my defects of character that created that situation. As a matter of fact, if a week before the wedding, if I would have hired a board of psychiatrists and sociologists and sat them down and said, listen, I got a job for you. I'm marrying this girl who's loyal and monogamous and a good person with character and ethics. You need to come up with a game plan that I could initiate over the next couple of years that would make her cheat on me. Can you do that? I'm telling you, they couldn't have come up with anything more effective than what I did the next couple of years. And yet, I'm a knucklehead. I'm asleep at the wheel. I don't even know I'm doing that because I can't see past myself and my job and my AA commitments and my stuff. I never got it. And I said to her, I said, I want you to know how sorry I am that I wasn't capable at the time of being there for you emotionally, that I left you so vacant that it drove you to do something I know today you would have never done, that you're a good person, you would have never done that. And she started to cry because all she ever wanted was for me to get it. You know, she just wanted me to get it. And she it almost ate her lunch. And Craig was easier. Craig's a guy. I know guys. I am one. Oh, jeez. When she, in her desolation and kind of resentment towards me, sexually opened the door for him, I mean, he just caved. I know how guys, you can have the best intentions in the world and a girl can touch you a certain way. And where did those intentions go? They were here a minute ago. I know how that is. I mean, it's, later on, you're kicking yourself. Why did I do that? He said to me one time, early sobriety, he was so lonely, couldn't even get a date for a long time. He said, He said, I just someday like to have what you have with Karen. I didn't know he meant specifically. I thought he meant kind of in a generalized manner. And I started to get free of it. I got free of it. And him and I are very good friends today. And her and I are very, I just talked to her. I'm sending her something. I never miss a Mother's Day with her because she's been a, if God and I would have sat down to try to craft the perfect mother for my daughter, we couldn't have done any better than Karen. She's amazing. And we're very good friends today. And probably always will be. Take a break. 10 minutes, 47 seconds. Oh, you know Craig?